What's going on, everyone? Welcome back to Stacking Slabs. This is your hobby content alternative. I'm your host, Brett McGrath. Today, we've got the collector conversation coming at you, unlocking a new character, Jason at Contrarian Cards, talking about the benefits of performing a high volume of activity in the hobby. Jason is constantly sharing his thoughts in the Patreon group, and they're always good thoughts. He is someone who I've made deals with. I know he performs a lot of activity, and I wanted to have him on the podcast today to share his thoughts and process. And man, this was a really fun conversation. I think you're going to enjoy it. If you are looking for a way to support the Stacking Slabs podcast and get further content, more exclusive content, all the things, join the Patreon today. And while you're at it, tell a damn friend about this show. Without further ado, let's kick into the conversation. All right, we are unlocking a new character here. We've got Jason at Contrarian Cards on the show today. I wanted to talk with him because we've made some deals. I've been following him for a while, and I just notice all of the activity he performs on a regular basis when it comes to cards, and I feel like learning about his process will likely benefit all of us listening. So the topic is the benefits of performing a high volume of activity in the hobby. I got Jason here, Contrarian Cards. We were just talking Colts, a fellow Colts fan. So welcome, Jason. How are you?
Good, man. First time, long time. Appreciate you unlocking me. Appreciate the invite. Stoked to talk cards, man.
Yeah, we're going to get to it. You put out like a pie chart of like your collection and what lanes you collect in. And I think it's really fun to think about our collections and if we were to break them all up into like a pie chart form, what it would look like. And we're going to get to that here in a minute, but this is a question I've like wanted to ask more guests. And I think it's just interesting because it can go anywhere, but I'm curious on your end, what is something that is going on right now in the hobby in general, in your world, in the hobby, but what is motivating you? What is exciting you most right now?
Yeah. So like big picture wise, like just broad, like I feel like there's just so much. I've heard you say this before too. It's like, there's just so much you can do. Like literally you could go weeks, months without buying a card. You can, you know, do social media stuff. You can do Instagram stuff. You can do collection management, inventory tracking. I like ranking my cards. I like making spreadsheets. I like looking at the cards I already own. I love grading. You know, that's more of a practical thing. But it's just the opportunities for like the individual hobbyist to just completely create their own, you know, adventure or path are just endless. Like you can, you know, work on being a seller. You can have an eBay store. You can, work on your Instagram page. You can make videos. I mean, even if nobody watches, just for your own, you know, creative fulfillment or enjoyment or however you want to do it. I mean, it's just endless, really. And that's what I like so much. It's like you can take so many different parts of yourself and your personality and apply it to this hobby, whether it's, you know, an entrepreneurial, you know, ambition or just like your love of art or sports or just all of that. So that's sort of the overall, you know, broad perspective on it. But then just practically, I've been really enjoying grading cards. I think it's a great time to be sending cards to PSA, you know, at $19, like that's such a reasonable price. The turnaround times are not bad. The graded cards, you know, they still have liquidity even at fixed price. You know, if you're pricing them reasonably and sending, you know, stuff that people want. I mean, that's always the challenge, of course. But yeah, that's kind of that's kind of where I'm at. What about you, man? What are you having fun with?
A lot of that stuff. I would say like two things primarily. One would be trying to find the cards that I really mm-hmm. want, as opposed to just buying stuff that pops my way that I think is cool. So I think like that evolution for me into like having some more patience and trying to network to the cards that I want has been something I've been focusing in more and more on. And like you mentioned, there's a lot of different things that we can do in the hobby. And like, I've just obviously been spending more time creating content. So like when I take a step back and think about it, like, I feel like there's just like this endless array of topics that I've always wanted to explore and that I'm interested in. So like doing that on a regular basis has definitely been motivating and enhancing my overall hobby experience. One of the things that I want to kick back to you that you mentioned that I think is really powerful, and it's like a breakthrough, I think, when you're able to do this, but like when you are in cards and you're in the hobby and you're doing what we're doing on a regular basis, like there's this need that we feel like we in order to continue to go forward, we have to buy cards. Like buying cards is like the perception is that that's the fuel for keeping this going, where I think as I've evolved as a collector, I've realized like that is not the case. And in fact, like my experience is likely better than if not buying a card like weekly, just because like I am able to focus in on the cards that I really want and save up money for those cards. So like, that's something that you mentioned that stuck out to me. Like, how do you think about buying? Like, are you okay if you're not buying cards weekly? What goes on in your head?
Yeah, I would agree with that in terms of just the evolution component. And it's definitely taken me a while. Like, I've been doing this pretty intensely, like every day, like for the last however many years now, just not like for extended periods, but thinking about it constantly and just always analyzing this stuff and analyzing myself and my sort of hobby behavioral patterns. And yeah, I'm at a place right now where I think I'd be completely content. If you told me like I couldn't buy a card, if I could buy like two cards the rest of this year, I think I'd be totally fine. Because like a lot of that is because I already have a lot of cards and there's a lot of, you know, like appreciating I can do and a lot of like, you know, little projects I can do to like entertain myself and whatnot. But yeah, I think that just constant just desire to like make your collection like better, but not bigger, I think is a real big part for me. Like I just, I'm on the heels of a big purchase. So like for me, just context wise, like I'd say like $1,500 is probably like my top end buy range where I'm comfortable. And I've only done that like a few times in my life now, but I'm coming off one of those. And so I've just been doing like a consolidation type situation these past couple weeks. And that honestly, it's a lot of fun for me to like make those tough choices. Like I really like that process of like, you know, whether you call it judgment day or consolidation or just a cost offsetting or what, like to me, I like make these little deals with myself. Like, all right, you know, if you buy this card, like you got to sell some stuff that you don't want to sell. You can't just default to like, okay, maybe, you know, maybe enough stuff will sell for my eBay. So I try to punish myself a little bit after that. And yeah, it's like, I don't know. I just feel like it makes it more interesting. Like, I'm in the camp of I'd prefer a much more complicated hobby than anything that's straightforward or easy to navigate. I want the cards, the best cards to be hard to find. I want my perspectives to change over time. I don't want to be, rigid or just like not, you know, evolving in terms of what my tastes are. But yeah, we'll get into more of that stuff later. But yeah, man, I'm totally cool not buying for extended periods of time. But then it seems like when a big card does come along, they always come in twos or threes. So then you're kind of in a tough spot too. But
it's always the case. I want to go back to that bigger purchase for you. So when that card came up, was it like you saw the card and you're like, I know I need this card. And so in order for me to feel comfortable with needing this card, I'm going to need to take my cards to like, I'm going to need to consolidate because I can't rely on my eBay store coming through for me in the time that I need to be. Like consolidation, I talk about a lot and it's different for everyone, but maybe that example specifically, like let listeners know, like exactly maybe why that whatever card it was, and then like the steps that you took in order to get to a point where you're like, all right, I feel really good about this decision. I feel like I've got everything covered.
Yeah. Well, so there's been two like $1,400 cards like back to back. And I finished the offset of the first. And that one, it just came out just massively priced. It was at the sweep me off my feet range. So I wasn't even like thinking about it seriously. And then I noticed that they cut the price in half. Like, and so at that point, you know, it had, you know, probably 20, 30 watchers on it. So I just sent like kind of an offer, I offered like $800. And I think they had priced it down to like 2000 or something. And I wasn't expecting much. It was just sort of a Hail Mary attempt. And they countered at like, I think it was 1300, which was, and there was a competing offer. So I didn't hesitate. I just instantly said yes. Like when it comes to the, like, it's so weird. Like when it comes to like $30 or $40 cards, like I think the price sensitivity is a lot more intense. Like people don't want to pay $33 for a $30 card, but But like when it comes to like like 1,000 or 1,400, like the difference just seems so minuscule. I don't know, maybe that's just me, but yeah, so that was, so instantly when I did that, I knew I was going to have some time because I was like, all right, it has to go to authentication. I don't want to sell like anything I'll regret selling and then have it fail authentication. So I kind of like work my way up to it. So I have like a list, like kind of in order of like what I'm like most willing to part with. And, you know, then like sort of it gets increasingly like panic mode type stuff. But yeah, so like, obviously it took me, yeah, like I said, about 2 weeks. I keep just sort of a loose like ranking of my cards. And I think for that card, it took me 19 days to offset that. And just for just like real specific context, I sold my, like I do a top 100 list every year, and number 94, 92, 57, 56, 54, and 52 were six of the, 13. Yeah. Six of the 13 cards were top 100. So it's, if you think about like, kind of like if you're in a draft, like if you're like trading up, you know, you want to get up to the first or second pick in the draft, and you have to like basically give the other team, you know, all your third rounders, all your fourth rounders, all your fifth rounders. So it's kind of like that. But yeah, and but theoretically though, that card could be, you know, easily top three like next year when I do this again. So I don't really hesitate when it comes to that sort of a thing.
I think everybody is prioritizing. I am, certainly after hearing the way you talk about that, but just ranking your cards. Mm-hmm. I see people do it. I've noticed you've done it over the years. Mm-hmm. And I think when you like, it helps justify that purchase. Yep. That you just made because you were rattling, everything was like over your top 50. And it's like, yeah, like I'd be willing to give up those, especially for a card that might enter into my top 10. So, I think that's super fascinating. And like thinking about like your collection in general, you posted on Instagram, you had like a pie chart of like what kind of broke up your collection or what would the makeup of the collection. Talk about the chart, like what motivated you to do that? And then like, I think this will help collectors understand who are listening, like what you collect, like talk about what that makeup of the chart was in terms of your lanes you collected.
So I do these like projects. I have a very small YouTube channel, and I really enjoy like slide presentations. It's probably not the most like visually captivating thing to watch, but I really love that kind of stuff. And so I was working on one of those, and I transfer like a lot of the data from my Google Sheets over to slides and just like insert chart or whatever. And so the way I did this was, it's just my graded cards. So only, but I think, you know, broadly speaking, it gives a pretty good representation. And the way I break it up is I use like what I call liquidation value. So that's like the fixed price number that, that I feel like I would have to list the cards at to sell them like in a very reasonable amount of time. So not the big time sweep me off my feet type prices. But just like, if I need to get the money now, this is the number it's going to have to be. Some cards are probably surely overestimated in value. Some are probably underestimated. So I think it probably balances out. And I try to be really conservative because I think people tend to overvalue their own cards, and I know I'm probably guilty of that at times as well.
We all are.
Yeah. So like, I'll estimate it, and then I'll knock it down like 25-30% to account for the fees and my own biases and whatnot. But generally speaking, it's broad representation. So the categories, I collect four main areas. Star Wars was the most, barely at 29.4%. Baseball, right behind that. And I guess just for context, when I'm talking about Star Wars, I'm talking like ultra modern parallels mostly, a few sketch cards, and then 2015 and newer type sets. Baseball, 29% total of PC. Again, ultra modern parallels mostly, veteran cards, no rookie stuff really, no autos, only two vintage cards. I have a 53 tops, Jackie and Satchel. And then subject wise, it's primarily Otani, Betts, and Francisco Lindor. And then a little segment of like 2000s game used relics and that type of thing. So those are the top two. And then non-sport was next at 25.1%. That's ultra modern tops wrestling, vintage Magic cards, vintage non-sport, so like celebrity Hollywood icon, you know, Liz Taylor, Marlon Brando type stuff. Yeah, and that category is very top heavy, so the cards are either really expensive or really affordable. And then football was the fourth at 16.6%. That's basically all 2000s stuff, or primarily the year 2000 specifically, Peyton, Marv, Edge, a little Reggie sprinkled in, and then just like some general era collecting with some of those sets from 2000 that I really enjoy.
So I would say, like, in terms of the Star Wars, the wrestling, the baseball, and the football, that, like, and, like, you've got, like, the pop culture, that is unique. Like, there's not many collectors out there who I would say, oh, you collect just like Jason. Where do those are those just like what you're the most interested in? Like, what is maybe the driving force behind each of those lanes?
Yeah. So football, obviously. I mean, Colts fan since I was a kid, obviously. So that's in, you know, that's my era, 2000. I was 16 years old, you know, huge Manning fan, just follow those teams like crazy. I love that era. You know, most people, when they tell their sort of hobby story, they were like, you know, junk wax era, left the hobby, came back, whatever. I made like this really intense pit stop back in 2000, specifically because of that 99 Colts team. I was just so captivated by it. They went 13-3, lost to the Titans, soul crushing defeat. But then the next year I was just so stoked on all those sets, like Fleer Ultra from 2000, Donruss Elite from 2000, Upper Deck 2000, and all is just such beautiful products. And, you know, back then, obviously nobody, now everybody thinks about Tom Brady when they think about the year 2000 in football cards. But back then, that just wasn't a thing. It was Ron Dane, Peter Ward, Chad Pennington, Cordy Brown, Sylvester Morris, you know, all these guys. Like, I so vividly remember that draft class, like, just because I was buying so many cards. Yeah, so that's a lot of the football stuff. Baseball, I would say, like, 2015, 2016, I got really into, like, daily fantasy sports and baseball a lot. Like, I was, you know, on FanGraphs, Baseball Reference constantly, looking at, you know, all these analytics and just playing, you know, 20, 30 bucks, whatever, here and there. And I was just really, I was just playing a lot of that stuff for a few years. So I just really got to fell in love with a lot of these guys that were really just statistically just excellent performers, like Mookie Betts, Francisco Lindor, Shohei Ohtani, the guys I collect. And so I've just, you know, developed a really strong connection with baseball, and then, and the history of it too. I think a lot of people will tell you, if they, like, younger people, when they get into vintage, like the Ken Burns documentary was really influential. I hear people talk about that all the time. Just they hear those stories about Satchel Paige and Jackie Robinson and Mickey Mantle and Ebbets Field and, you know, Connie Mack and all these just iconic figures in the game. So I'm really captivated by that stuff as well. And then Star Wars, I love Star Wars. My mom took me to see the remastered trilogy when it came out in 97, 98, something like that. And then obviously the prequels, I was in high school. I like the sequel trilogy. I know it's pretty polarizing and a lot of people don't, but I really enjoy it. And and that was pandemic era stuff too for me. That was The Rise of Skywalker was the last movie I saw in the theater prior to, you know, everything. And so I really connect with a lot of that 2020 ultra modern Star Wars type stuff. And yeah. And then wrestling, a lifelong wrestling fan, WWE, watched all the pay-per-views with my family, Mr. Perfect, Bret Hart, SummerSlam, just NWO, Savage, DDP, all the house shows, just all of it, dude. I follow so much of that stuff online too. Like, I'm always, you know, listening to Fightful and Denise Salcedo and Sean Ross Sapp, and I want to hear all the dirt and just yeah, best $5 in the business and all that sort of thing. So,
the more I hear, like, learn about you and listen to what you like and collect, the more, like, I'm like, man, we're very similar. I'm a Fightful. Shout out Fightful, all you wrestling nerds out there. $5, get all the dirt, all the content. I'm right there with you, pal. Yeah. Give it to me all. One thing I just want to comment on, just because I think this resonated with me as you were talking about that, but, like, the remastered Star Wars, like, when those came in the theater, and, like, the time frame and the era of my life when I went back in the theater. And I'm not sure, dude, if I would, like, even know or be able to, like, understand the significance of the Star Wars, of Star Wars in general, if it wasn't for those. And I think about that, like, I remember getting the remastered box set after seeing all of them for Christmas, VHS tapes. And that, like, that moment, like, made me interested in everything else that's come afterwards. And so I don't know, like, maybe it's that era of, like, people around our age. Like, do you, like, to me, you mentioned it, I it resonated with me. Do you think, like, what do you think life would be like without that decision to remaster all of those films and put them on the big screen again?
Well, for me, I think it would be totally different. I had never seen them. That was the first time I'd ever saw the films. So, like, I mean, I, like, vaguely had memories of like Darth Vader, like as a kid, maybe if it was on TV or something like that. But when I went to those movies as like a whatever 12, 13 year old, whatever it was at the time, like that was an unreal experience. Like I had no idea what was going to happen in The Empire Strikes Back. I remember my mom and I think I was with my mom and my aunt maybe. And I remember him tapping me on the shoulder telling me, all right, pay attention. Like when that scene's coming up with Vader and Luke at the end. I also really associate that with, like, I think Taco Bell was running like some type of promotion back then, because I remember we would go to like Taco Bell afterwards every time and they had like maybe like collector cut anyway. But yeah, I think it's massive because like people our age, we weren't around, you know, in the '70s to see the long lines and to hear all the hype and whatnot. It would be like, you know, trying to explain, you know, like appointment viewing, like peak Game of Thrones to somebody, you know, 10, 15 years from now or something. This was a really big deal. Trust me. So yeah, I definitely, those were really big experiences for me and at a really important time in my life too, you know, just where, you know, you were still young enough to really just look up and idolize, you know, Luke Skywalker and be, you know, have, you know, just be so captivated by Vader and just his presence and all that. It was just the Death Star and just all of it was just so incredible. And I remember being really impressed with the CGI too, because they like added those things in and that was a big deal and a big part of it. And now that seems kind of ridiculous just compared to what they do today. But yeah, for sure. That was massive. And I know exactly what you're talking about. Like with the box set too, I would watch Empire every single night, Empire and Sandlot, Grease, like those types of movies. Like I would just literally watch those like every single day, just over and over again. So that kind of stuff is like deeply, deeply embedded in me. And I think it probably definitely drives a lot of this kind of hobby behavior that I'm engaged in.
Did you mention Grease? Are you Danny Zuko, Mark?
Yeah. And I like Grease too. Also.
Wow.
Yeah. I don't know. I listen to the soundtrack pretty often. Like when I go to the gym or whatever, I'll listen to all those songs, like Cool Rider. That's a great song. Michelle Pfeiffer. Grease, obviously the theme is tremendous, but yeah, huge. I wish I would have brought one of my Danny Zuko cards. That film was so good. I mean, everything except the part where they do the hairdressing or the dream sequence with Frankie Valli, I think. And yes. That part I kind of tune out, but great movie.
I love, my favorite part of that is his transformation into being a track athlete and dropping the cigarette, yeah, then going and running. I'm glad. Hey, we've got a first time here. We've never talked about Grease on Stacking Slabs, so thank you, Jason. But back to Star Wars. I'm curious. I just, from your page, I see you post the cards. There's a couple other collectors here and there that post the cards. Obviously, like massive franchise. Maybe for anyone who has no idea about Star Wars cards, I think it's like, it resonates with me that they're like Topps Chrome, like that's cool. But like, what's something you'd share about just Star Wars cards to people like me who don't really know anything about them?
This kind of goes for wrestling too, but, if you were totally new to the category, I would say, a couple things. One, the continuity is really good. So it crossed, like if you're a Topps collector, you got the gold 50s, the, you know, the red five, the super fractors, all the chrome type stuff that you're probably familiar with, the X fractors. So that's a nice sort of way for people to like sort of think about it. But I think one of the benefits of like Star Wars and wrestling relative to sports is you can really like collect them like categorically and be like pretty comfortable with it. So there's like so many pairings. If you think like Vader and Luke, you know, Maul and Qui-Gon, Rey and Kylo, Leia, Han, you know, just everything works well together. Where, I mean, you can do a lot of that stuff in sports too, obviously, but just in Star Wars and wrestling, like it's a very just like collective experience. Like I want to have a Yoda card. I want to have a Padme card. I want to have a Obi-Wan card. I want to have, you know, just the nicest possible card of all these, you know, Ahsoka, Sabine, if you're into the newer stuff. Yeah, Ezra, whoever. So it's just that I would tell people just to not worry too much about like picking a character or I mean, you could definitely do that if you want to, but yeah. And it's not really hard to navigate the sets either, just because it's most of the, and I should say just for context, I only really dabble in the newer stuff. Basically 2014 was the first Chrome kind of similar to wrestling in that way. 2014, 2015, you had chrome sets. And then there was like nothing until 2018. That was the first Finest set. 2019 to 2021, you had a few sets in there. 2022 Finest. And then you got the Galaxy sets, which were probably the first sort of mainstream breakout for Star Wars with the, you know, influencers and stuff like that. So
I always like to ask this question in like these categories that I know nothing about. But like, if you look at, you know, football cards, for instance, right, you've got, in terms of value, you've got, you know, Brady, you know, you got Mahomes, you got Manning, and it just like goes down. And same basketball, same for everything else. But like, what does that look like for Star Wars? Is there consistency with like the characters that, you know, demand the most value consistently across sets?
I would say it's less like tippy top, where, you know, in sports, you know, you've got a big drop off from like the elite high demand players, from the Mahomes to like, who would you say in football, like, what is it right now? I mean, like, prospects aside, but like of the established guys, obviously Mahomes. And then who would even be after that? Like, is it like Lamar Jackson? Or
I would say it's more maybe in flux than it has been in the past, but I would say like Josh Allen, Lamar Jackson. But you know, like, if it's hard,
but there's a big spread there, right? I mean, between,
if you want to include like a CJ Stroud too, on just the potential. But yeah, there's a drop. I would say there's Mahomes, and then it's kind of everybody else right now in terms of active players.
So like with Star Wars, I would say I you know, I'm obviously biased, but I would say Vader typically at the top. You know, the most iconic, you know, movie villain of all time. And then you've really got a lot, like, I would say that sort of that high end demand tier, you know, Anakin, Padme, Grogu, Rey, maybe most people like probably would think Luke, but I would say probably he's probably a level below that, which might catch some people off guard because he was, you know, obviously the main character. But this is just basically from what I see in terms of like sales and stuff. Ahsoka has been pretty high demand. Just, I mean, because of the newer show with Rosario Dawson, people love Clone Wars and Rebels. Yoda, I mean, I would say kind of Vader is sort of in that, maybe in that class by himself. And then that next tier down, probably your Anakin's, Padme, Rey, Ahsoka, maybe Yoda. Mando, perhaps. Cassian's been pretty, you know, well received. A lot of people like that show. And then, you know, you got kind of Luke. Oh, Leia's probably pretty high up there too. Your classic sort of Obi-Wan, Qui-Gon, Maul. But it's really close though. It is like, it depends on the card. The card type's really important. I got this Vader here. This from 22 Finest. This is the black out of 10. So I mean, if you have if you got a nice, you know, card type or whatever, it can supersede the subject demand pretty easily. Like, I feel basically priced out of super fractors in Star Wars, where in baseball and wrestling, that's stuff that I can still afford. But yeah, so it's a lot of it is card type. So
I'm not sure that there's a better goat of black refractors than Vader himself. That looks like pretty sharp card of black on black for sure.
Yeah, this is copy number 1-2, and my buddy has number, I think he still has it, number 10 of 10, so it's kind of a fun friend connection for us.
That's awesome. Now, I know you do you do a lot. Like, we opened with just the volume of activity and just, like, project process, and you do a lot of buying, selling, and grading. Do you feel like the world you live in with cards and all that you do is organized? Is it not organized? Like, talk maybe a little bit about that and just your overall process.
Yeah. So on the buying side, whenever I'm buying cards, like, I'm always buying them for me first. Like, the intent is very, very rarely, ever to buy something specifically to sell. So I'm sort of using myself as a collector as like the barometer, probably not the most optimal like business plan, so to speak, but I do feel it protects me from the downside risk a little bit, because all these cards that I'm buying and, you know, grading, like, I'm happy to own them and keep them for very long periods of time just because I like them so much. But what happens is, you know, things happen, new cards come to you know, my attention or whatever, and you have to make decisions and things have to change. So yeah, that's the buying side. And then when it comes to grading, I love just the process of like composing orders. Like I'll typically, like, I don't know if other people do this, but I like to send in smaller orders just to like kind of protect myself from the variance of like a harsh or more lenient grader. I'd rather have like a big spread. So like if it's like, I'll tend to send like 3 or 4 big PC cards and like maybe 8 to 9 what I call hybrid cards, which are cards I'm sort of on the fence. Like, would I sell it? Would I keep it? And then maybe like 4 or 5 cards that I'm pretty confident that I would end up selling just to kind of offset the fees and the variance of the results and whatnot. Probably losing money on shipping, but I figure like if it's just 1 or 2 tens go one way or the other, it kind of offsets that $40 or whatever. So yeah, that's the buying and grading. You know, selling, it's like I tend to just kind of try to work with the market. If the market values something more than I do significantly, you know, I'll sell it. If the market, if I value a card at, you know, $200 and the market tries to tell me it's $75, I'll keep it. You know, it's like these are all rare cards. You know, very rarely am I posting something for sale that has any other listings. If I do, I'll just undercut every other seller immediately. I just don't deal in cards like that. It just has never made sense to me. Not that there's anything wrong with that by any stretch of the imagination, but for me, I'd rather be the only one with the card and then, you know, engage in a negotiation with another individual that also wants the card. So yeah, that's kind of how I think about it. I adjust price pretty frequently. You know, I don't have a ton of time for this. So usually each morning, like when I'm having coffee, I'll just go into my eBay seller dashboard and I'll check all the, like the view to watch ratios, see what people are looking at, what people are ignoring. And you can pretty easily tell what needs to be marked down, just do a bulk edit, knock everything down 10%. I'll do that like almost every day until it sells, or just end and relist the items if they're literally, you know, completely out of the algorithm and not getting any views or whatever. So yeah, a lot of that kind of stuff. And that it might sound like kind of mundane and, you know, like a waste of time, but over if you do it long enough, you just sort of build your own process for it and you can do it very quickly. So yeah. And then on Instagram, literally, I had no idea what a story post even was until like 3 weeks ago. So I've been probably just experimenting with those, and that's helped considerably. Like I can't believe, like, I had no idea that was even like such a thing that people looked at. And like, so that's been an absolute blast. Like eBay, yeah, I just got to shout out eBay. Like it's probably not a cool thing to do, but eBay is so good. Like, I think their fees are completely reasonable. The platform is just so, for individual sellers, like it's awesome. I mean, for whatever, I don't even know, I pay $20-$25 a month maybe for a store. And it's just tremendous. Like you can do like newsletters and promotions and coupons, and it's really cool. So yeah, appreciate anybody at eBay that's listening to this. So
I always love it when people organically come on the show and just shout out products and services that they love. Maybe you alluded to it in this last question as we're kind of rounding the corner on this episode, but you mentioned kind of the cards you get are rare and scarce cards that maybe other people don't have. I think you sent a picture. I think it might've been in the, either to my IG or in the Patreon chat, one of the two, but you were like, this is the kind of cards I used to collect, and this is kind of what I collect now. Maybe talk a little bit about that evolution and just like what those changes were and why.
Yeah. Another cool thing about Instagram, if you go back and sort by your oldest post, you can really reflect. And I've been doing some of that. And it's like a few things stood out to me. I mean, it was basically all raw cards. And back then there was like a real premium on cards that were already graded just because of how inconvenient it was. The turnaround times are super long. Now it's like completely flipped. I'm putting a big emphasis on raw cards that I could grade myself and add value to. I also connect with the cards more that way. I love grading my own cards. It's like another step in the process that makes you feel, you know, more connected to the card, you know, just being a part of the entire journey, so to speak. So a lot of that kind of stuff, more focused on value at the like higher end of my price range. So if you think about like the card you spent $20 on, if you pull yourself back and say, all right, well, if I don't buy this, I could put that 20 towards a $40 card, and that 40 towards an $80 card, and that 80 towards a $200 card, and that 200 towards a $600. And you're almost always getting so much more quality the higher you go, because there's less people are willing to spend that much money on a single card. So it's like those psychological, like I've said, you know, on this episode, like my psychological barrier is about $1,500. So if there's a card at $2,000, you're not going to have to compete with me, because I'm going to be afraid to buy it unless I can figure out some other sort of plan. So I, that really, like, I was gonna, how many cards do you typically have on your watch list, would you say?
That's a great question. It fluctuates, but like I just like went through and cleaned one up because, you know, you get through that phase of like, this card has been on my watch list forever. The seller's not going to give me an offer. I'm not going to buy it at this price. So I eliminate it. I would say ideally it would be around like 20 would be like ideal, around 20.
So I usually have like hundreds in 20. That I didn't expect.
That's ideal. But it's inflated most of the time by stuff I'll never buy. I hit watch on everything. But also I like to watch cards that that I have no intention of buying too, because it's a card that's like mine or adjacent to it, type of a thing.
Gotcha. Yeah. So the reason I ask is just because I like to play this game where myself, where I'll sort by highest. So I'll start at the top and I'll just scroll all the way down and I'll just pick like, all right, you know, I typically have like 300 or 400 cards on there and I'll just be like, all right, well, these three are obviously the best value. And typically they're the more expensive cards. The one of ones, the fives, whatever, the really rare 2000 stuff. And I just see that trend play out over and over and over again. And it's, so that's been a big change, is just focusing more on spending up and getting more value there at higher price points. But relatively speaking, it seems like a better card. And then just the other thing I'd say on that evolution is just like kind of knowing when to pivot, and just making slight pivots. Like I started out by just like going so far all over the place, all these obscure cards, these obscure sets, these obscure categories. And now I feel like I've just really like tightened things up in terms of, I still go pretty broad in terms of subject, but it's really tight in terms of card type. So the super fractors, the gold stuff that I like, and, you know, the very, very specific set of like football cards and sets and whatnot. So I feel like, I feel like you've kind of done that too. It's like, you run a pretty tight operation, but it seems like you have to, you know, whether it's the prism golds or the blacks or whatever, you like to sort of kind of focus on those, which I think I can really identify with that as well.
It's more fun that way. And it's taken me a long while. It's like, you just look at your collection and you figure out, these are the cards that I really like. So it allows you to, it has allowed me to like focus in, because when you collect a certain player, it's so hard because there's so many different ways you can approach it. So I've become over the years just more of a fan of, like, I know I love Prism Gold with all of my heart for all the reasons. So instead of like wondering what I should buy, why don't I be more focused and get like the Prism Gold run of a player that I really like? So yeah, that's just, but that's not the way I thought 2 years ago. And it'll probably change next year. It just, it's part of the evolution of all of it.
Yeah, that's, I look forward to that too. I like watching, and I like, that's why I like all this tracking stuff, is you can really look back and sort of reflect on your behavior and what you did right, what you feel could have been better and all that sort of a thing. So yeah, that's kind of where I'm at with it.
Maybe we close out with somebody, I know you do your lists, so you're very organized, but like, what are your top, right now in your collection, what are your kind of top few cards?
I'll try to do this quick here so we can show a few. So this is number one. This was card of the year last year, currently number one in the clubhouse. This is the 2023 flag, the Topps Chrome Super Fractor for Mookie Betts, 101. Really cool design on the 2023. I like that lower third because you got the player image, cool Dodgers logo, and the 101 placement is right there above the logo, the team name. So that's cool. This was a card, came to market. The seller priced it at $1,200 as a minimum bid. At auction, but they had the offer featured on there, and I just randomly, as like, offered $800, and then I didn't think about it. And I was watching TV or something, and I checked my phone and saw that it ended, and I was like, oh, somebody else must have bought it. And then I had like my card was charged. I was like, oh wow, that's pretty cool. So that was pretty rad. Number two, this is another baseball card here. This is the Heritage Gold from 2023 for Otani. These are out of five. So these are it for you. Basketball or these are kind of my prism golds, so to speak. I think this is the kind of my favorite card type right now, is these Heritage. It's kind of hard to see in the camera, but these shine really nice. And a cool thing too is you get the, on the back, it's got that like vintage card stock, so you get like sort of that juxtaposition of old and new, like with baseball. So that's number two. Wrestling, obviously, Bret Hart. This is my favorite wrestling card here, 2020 finest Bret Super. Obviously, 2020 finest is such a great set. And you know, I'm primarily a tops collector. So I've been a little bit phased out of wrestling for the past couple of years, but I'll be back when things change. And if it doesn't change, I'll just have to start buying gold prisms or something. But, and then Star Wars, I showed that Vader earlier, but that was probably my favorite card, but this is cool. This is a sketch card here. So for anybody not familiar, this is like hand drawn art. This is Rey from the scene in Rise of Skywalker with Palpatine. She's got both lightsabers there, deflecting the Force lightning. The artist signs the back of these. So Semra, Balut, pretty cool. So that's my favorite Star Wars card right now. Besides that Vader I showed earlier, but yeah. And then I showed this to you earlier, but this is a football card, Edge Spectrum 2000. I'd say this is my favorite football card currently, but the Peyton will supersede it when it comes back from PSA. So
such a diverse collection, and I love the way you think about the hobby and your collecting and approach. You can follow him at Contrarian Cards. Jason, this was a blast to chat about. We'll have to do it again because I know there's more to talk about, and yep. I think we can go deeper next time, but appreciate it, man.
Yeah, thanks, man. This was a blast. I love talking cards. I'll bring my grease cards next time.
we'll have grease is the word as the intro to the next episode.
Yeah. All right, man.
Man, that was fun. I am just on a ringer talking with a bunch of new collectors that I haven't on this show, and it is motivating. Check out Jason at Contrarian Cards. While you're at it, do the damn thing. Check out the Patreon group. See if it's for you. If that's the best way you can show your support for what I'm doing up here. Take care of yourself. Take care of others around you. More Stacking Slabs on the other side.